Today I have John Galloway. John is a community program manager on the .NET team, and he's the executive director of the .NET Foundation. He's also a good friend since, I don't know, John, 2005?
A long time. Sounds about right. It's all a blur at this point.
How are you?
Yes.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Well, I'm glad you're here. We've had you on the podcast before, and it's always at least entertaining. What have you been up to lately? What would you like to talk about?
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, so I've been at the .NET Foundation for the past couple of years, and some of the stuff we've been up to, you know, that's been keeping me busy has been kind of transforming to more of a community-run thing. So .NET Foundation's always been separate from Microsoft, but it hasn't been that obvious. And so Microsoft hasn't been getting the full benefits, and the community hasn't been either. And so we, over the past year, have kind of transformed into a member-run organization a lot more obviously. So we had community elections back in May, and then the community board, there's seven people on the board. One of them works for Microsoft and the rest don't. We have, so six people, you know, including, I'll rattle them off, but I'll probably forget some. So we have John Skeet over at Google. We have Sarah Chips. We have Iris. Sarah Chips is working at Stack Exchange and Stack Overflow now. We have Iris Klassen, Phil Hack, Phil Hack fame previously at GitHub and stuff. Ben Adams and Oren Novotny. So, you know, great group of community leaders. And so, and the way, you know, when I say I'm the executive director, that sounds like a big title, but the executive director reports to and works for the board of directors. So they set the direction, they make the decisions, and my job is to execute on, you know, what they want to get done. So, yeah, so that's been really exciting and, you know, definitely a growing challenge to move from a, hey, it's just a couple of people sending emails back and forth and throwing a spreadsheet up in SharePoint to we're scaling out to work with seven board members and hundreds of you know .NET Foundation members and kind of do bigger things and have it run by and have the community like decide what we want to do.
That's very cool.
Yeah. As part of that, looking at you know what are some bigger things that we can do, like so things like supporting more projects, reaching more developers, putting together stuff for meetups and speakers, all kinds of stuff. And the idea here is that it's, you know, Microsoft supports the .NET Foundation, but we have a lot of other companies that are part, and we have, you know, the whole community we report to too. So we have about 80 people now on a project leader Slack for, you know, leaders of projects that have joined the .NET Foundation. We recently at .NET Conf, AWS joined as a corporate sponsor. So, you know, along with, you know, Google and Red Hat, Samsung, JetBrains, all these other, you know, large companies. And it's neat that all three of the large cloud hosting providers are members of the .NET Foundation too.
Yeah, I was impressed that you said AWS, given Microsoft has renamed itself Azure Incorporated.
It's not wrong. That's actually, I think it's important to kind of make that point that the .NET Foundation is not Microsoft. It's not owned by Microsoft. It's not run by Microsoft. Microsoft's a part. So is AWS. So is Google. Kind of in the same way that Microsoft, you know, is a member of the Node Foundation or the Linux Foundation. You know, it's Microsoft's a member of the .NET Foundation, and so are these other companies. So it really is you know, and the whole a big reason why Microsoft created .NET Foundation 5 years ago is to make that clear and to make it easier for other companies and other people to get involved and not just see it as a Microsoft product.
Right. Okay. I'm going to switch on you. You're a community PM. What does that mean?
Yeah. So the .NET team has a community PM group and it's led by Scott Hanselman. And then so his team working for him, he's got Jeff Fritz, Maria Nagaga, Jamie Singleton, Nish just joined, and then myself. And so we kind of focus on all just kinds of different PM stuff. A lot of my time, basically Microsoft is kind of donating that to the .NET Foundation, kind of in the same way that, you know, companies have, you know, say like 20% time for people to work on an open source project. And then there's other stuff that I do that's you know, just things like helping with events, you know, put a lot of work into .NET Conf, which was in September, and, you know, things like building workshops and just kind of sometimes stuff behind the scenes, talking to people and, you know, figuring out how the .NET team can collaborate with Unity and stuff. So,
okay. Would it make sense to talk with you about .NET Core 3 and ASP.NET Core? Is that in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I've been a developer. I've been an ASP.NET developer for a long time. And then one way that I keep in touch with what's going on with ASP.NET is through the .NET community standups. So we've had the .NET community standup started as it was something we just did like on YouTube, live YouTube shows, and it was really pretty informal. We did those once a week every Tuesday, and then over time we've expanded. Now it's on Twitch as well, and we also have Thursday shows that include other .NET development. I forget what we call them. Development. It's not a platform, but you know, like so. For instance, desktop and mobile and languages and cloud and all that. So anyhow, I try to keep up with ASP.NET, and my you know, selfish way of doing that sometimes is that I invite guests onto the ASP.NET community stand up to talk about stuff I'm interested in. So
okay, so how do I find that? Is that on Channel 9?
It is, but the easiest way, you can go to dot.net/standup.
Okay.
It's also just directly on the .NET website. So if you just go to dot.net and then at the top, there's a thing in the navigation community. Click on community. And then in that page, you scroll down a little bit and it has community standups.
Great.
Yeah. And so there's actually, as we're speaking right now, there's one live. This is Visual Studio talking about stuff for Visual Studio in .NET. And So to your original question, .NET Core just shipped at .NET Conf in September, I think September 23rd, and a ton of good stuff in there. I'm not sure where to start. I definitely, like, I skew towards a lot of web stuff. So there's, you know, with ASP.NET, there's a lot of stuff for microservices, gRPC, SignalR, Blazor.
Whoa, slow down. What's gRPC?
gRPC originally came from, I think it was Google RPC, and it's, you know, you can, I mean, I don't know. You can kind of think of it as, you know, roughly similar to like, what do we call it? WCF or something. You know, it's a way for remote procedure calls. It was originally created by Google and has support for a lot of different languages and platforms. And so that was a push as part of the whole microservice, you know, making microservices awesome for .NET Core. It was including gRPC in that. So there's, they work directly with the gRPC team and, you know, built out really good support for gRPC. So
just to clarify, I want to let you go on about .NET Core, but we're talking .NET Core 3, is that right?
Yes. Yep. So yeah, so 3 just shipped. 3.1 previews just shipped this week, and so 3.1 is kind of a servicing release, and then the next one after that is going to be .NET 5. So .NET Core 3.0 was the one that just shipped.
And the next one is .NET not Core 5?
It's just called .NET 5, and part of the reason for that is to just, it's been confusing for people who are not, you know, reading the blogs every day and keeping up. It's hard because there's been .NET Framework and .NET Core, and people are confused. We've actually talked to, you know, people that are in technology management, like your CTOs, and they'll say, .NET Core is on version 3, but .NET Framework is on version 4.8. The biggest version number must be better, so I'm going to use .NET Framework. And, you know what I mean? It's been confusing over time. .NET Core has been out for, gosh, like almost 5 years now, and it's pretty mature at this point. And so, you know, we're really recommending for new development people use .NET Core. And so it just kind of makes it more obvious that we're just calling it .NET at this point. Also, when .NET Core first came out, part of the idea with calling it Core was it was this kind of stripped down, you know, like .NET Framework had gotten kind of big and was seen as sort of bloated and slow. And so .NET Core was this core thing. Over time, we've actually actually added on support for, I forget, 120,000 APIs from .NET Framework. And it's not just this tiny little core anymore. It has support for WinForms, WPF, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. And so now we're really kind of considering it. It's just .NET. So,
right.
Yeah. So that's...
Right. I've been spending a fair amount of time with C# 8, and you need to have .NET Core 3 in order for that to work. So that was my introduction to Core 3.
Yeah, and that's really considered, you know, the whole thing that, you know, we always have to be clear on all the wording that, you know, .NET Framework ships with Windows, so it's supported for the whole Windows lifecycle, you know, and it continues to receive all the, you know, security fixes and all that kind of stuff. So, and also there's a lot of products from Microsoft that have been built with .NET Framework. And so Microsoft needs .NET Framework support, just like a lot of other companies do. So .NET Framework continues to be supported, but .NET Core is the kind of, it's the new thing that's going to be getting the new features, that's going to be updated and stuff. And part of the design with .NET Core has been to make it so that we can update .NET without breaking people. We had cases in the past where a new version of .NET Framework shipped included some sort of bug and affected lots of people. There's, you know, like billions of computers with Windows installed. And if there's a bug in .NET Framework, there's only one .NET Framework on a machine, and it can cause big problems. We had problems with a bug like on tax day. I think it was Canadian tax day or something. And it affected, like, people couldn't file their taxes or whatever, right? So it's a big deal. So the nice thing with .NET Core is it can be, you can have multiple versions of .NET Core on a machine. You can ship a .NET Core application as a self-contained. So it brings along its own NuGet packages and everything to run that version of the .NET Framework. And then in .NET Core 3, there's actually support for EXEs. So a single EXE that includes, you know, everything you need. So you can finally now, with .NET Core 3, build just an EXE, throw it on a USB or whatever, and you know, like a flash drive, or, you know, just it's a single file that runs, and you don't have to say, okay, now go down, you know, make sure you have this version of .NET Framework and all that. It's just here's your program. So
it's great.
Yeah.
Let me back up to ASP.NET. I had a fair amount of experience. I had a lot of experience with web forms, and then along came we're not going to do web forms anymore, and we're going to do, it's still called ASP.NET, but it was substantially different.
Yeah.
And there were Razor pages.
Well, yeah. So there was a progression. We had web forms, and then we had MVC, and MVC was very heavily inspired. I think it's pretty obvious, and that, you know, anyone that worked on it wouldn't argue that it was pretty strongly inspired by, like, Ruby on Rails, and just the MVC pattern had gotten pretty popular with web development. Web forms was really focused on, hey, the web is hard. You know, coming out like 2001-ish. At that time, the web was kind of new to people. Browsers didn't adhere to any standards. CSS was confusing. JavaScript was confusing. And so the whole idea was, let's build components that desktop developers can drag and drop onto, you know, a designer surface, set properties, double click on them, fill in the event code, and you're basically bringing the desktop development model to the web. And that abstraction helped to bring, you know, desktop developers, including myself, onto the web. But then you started hitting all these abstraction problems where you're, you know, by the time that MVC shipped, browsers had actually gotten pretty good. Standards were starting to kick in. We had libraries like jQuery and stuff that made the web a pretty compelling development platform, and web forms just wasn't the right abstraction anymore. So MVC came along, and, you know, you're writing your models and views and controllers. And I was, you know, along with a lot of other people, I wrote several books on MVC and, you know, learned how to use it. And over time, I realized that I was... And so that was kind of the main thing. When ASP.NET Core shipped, MVC was the pattern that you know, came along. So you had the MVC pattern, and then you also had APIs. If you just wanted to, you know, have an API controller that had JavaScript or, you know, return JSON or XML or whatever, right? So that was cool. Over time, though, we realized we were writing a lot of boilerplate code, and MVC was sometimes not the best model either. MVC can work great if you have, you know, a view that is binding to a model and has very clear like controller actions. And that does work, you know, maybe for some kind of CRUD things or whatever. But there's a lot of cases where it didn't fit well. So one example would be if you're writing a lot of controller actions that just say return view. There's no model right there. The controller isn't doing anything worthwhile. All I want to do really is have a page that, you know, maps to a URL. Other cases we ran into were the model, you didn't actually want to bind directly to your models normally in your controller actions because there were, you know, security issues and things with overbinding. You know, we told people, well, you really should be using a view model. And so now, okay, great, I got to write a view model, but, you know, you're not really telling me how to do that. And I have to go read a book how to do it. And why am I creating all these models and view models and what goes where? And now I need a mapper to map between them. And, you know, so it wasn't the best pattern. So over time, they came up with this new thing called Razor Pages. And Razor Pages it's built on top of MVC. So anything you need that was in MVC, you can kind of reach down into, you know, the MVC primitives that Razor Pages is built on. But MVC is a lot more like an MVVM style. And so you've got page model, you've got a page and a page model. And the page model has properties and then it has methods on it. And the methods, you know, it supports conventions. Like if you have a get method or a post or whatever, it's those HTTP verbs and they map directly to page model actions. So, So for a lot of people that I talked to that had been web forms developers, and then they said MVC is way too confusing, Razor Pages was a much better fit because it feels a little bit more like the simplicity of code behind in a page. Here I have a page model and it has, you know, it has properties that I can bind to in my page and it has you know, methods that are HTTP methods and it's just a lot more straightforward. And then I can go in and create any other properties I want. I can have multiple model classes, whatever, but I can just bind to my page model. So I can create like utility methods that say like is user logged in or, you know, has data or whatever, that kind of stuff, and bind to that. So
well, now let's go back. When you say binding for me is binding data to controls, but that's not what you mean.
It's similar. It's more like model binding. So inside your Razor, Razor's, you know, it's your HTML with C# markup in it. And yep. And so in my Razor markup, I can just say like at model dot whatever. And so I can, you know, and this is a one-way binding, but I can basically grab my model data and do stuff with it. I can output it or I can use it for logic. So I can say model dot, you know, has order, you know, or mm-hmm. you know what I mean? So I can do some things using yes. Boolean. And so the page model, by setting those properties, it allows me to really simplify Razor logic. I don't really need to have any logic in my Razor view. I can put that in simple properties, utility properties and stuff.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Back when I was doing ASP.NET, I was using it for the front end and for the back end. Mm-hmm. And now there is Blazor and React and Angular and Vue. And can you try to help me fit that together with ASP.NET?
Yeah. There's a lot of options. So, So back in the simpler days, we had, you know, web forms and it handled everything for us. And every web form was a form. It was an HTML form. And so anything I filled out on it and clicked a button or did something, it would be posting that form back to the server. And it managed state for me and it did all that. Over time, people, browsers got more powerful, standards got better, JavaScript programmers just kept JavaScripting. And so we ended up with a lot more expectations of web applications and, you know, a lot more capabilities and stuff. And so where we got to with that was single page applications. And with the single page app model, you have HTML and JavaScript on the front end, and then you have an API on the back end. And the API, I would be interacting from the page via JavaScript, and I wouldn't be posting back to the server. I would just be, you know, sending little updates to the server and getting new information back from the server and updating within the page itself. So things like jQuery, and then, jQuery was okay, but it didn't handle all the complexities of updating the pages and how do I handle state and how do I, you know, map things. And as I'm building a more complex application on the front end, I need framework on the front end. And so that's where we got, you know, Angular and React and Vue, and they all have different kind of approaches, different kind of heaviness. And, you know, Angular is kind of a more, it's more of an application model. It has kind of, I feel like, simplified over time, but it's still a little bit, I feel like it's kind of a little heavy. It's a good fit if you're building, you know, a full-on application, but sometimes it's a little bit much. So React came out. It's more of a component model. It has a different feel in that you're mixing in inside your JavaScript. Now you have a template syntax that looks like HTML. So, you know, your component itself can include the template in this JSX format. And over time, then people have, you know, it originally, when I saw it, the selling points of React were it's lightweight, it's fast. It can render a ton of data really quickly because it doesn't have this whole kind of complex thing to focus on these components. Over time, though, people said, well, I need state management. Okay, here's Redux and here's Flux and here's all these other things. And then people said, well, I need application lifecycle and I need all this stuff. And so React, over time, there's ways to kind of build that up in a more complex manner too. And I don't mean to bash on complexity. If you're building a full-on application, you need to build a full-on application. And so you need that stack. And then Vue, again, Vue is kind of a lightweight, yes, Vue-focused front-end thing. So that does kind of step back again and just say like, hey, here's some additional markup and a JavaScript library. And we're not concerned with building, you know, we're concerned with rendering a Vue. So you give me some stuff and I'll render it out and and then with all of these things, you end up needing to deal with packaging. So then we end up with things like Grunt and Gulp and Webpack. And these are all, and you know, Broccoli, and there's a lot more of them. And they're all focused on, okay, I've got a ton of JavaScript libraries with a lot of dependencies, and I've probably got them on my computer using NPM. And now a lot of NPM packages include, you know, the full source, and they include licenses, and they include demo projects and all this stuff. And so some NPM packages are, you know, themselves pretty big, megabytes of size. Plus NPM itself, like, because of the way it handles dependencies, you can end up with a ton of, you know, your node modules folder can be hundreds of megabytes, right? It can be enormous. So then people use Webpack and Grunt and Gulp and Broccoli and et cetera to just grab the specific dependencies and bundle them together and send them down to the client.
And do those four things all do roughly the same thing? Grunt, Grow, Broccoli, which I've never heard of.
Yes, sort of. Yes, they do it in anyone that knows them deeply will say, well, but I mean, yes, there are things that they handle build tasks and bundling for JavaScript and front end.
Okay, so I have two questions. I don't know which to ask first. One is Blazor, mm-hmm. Before you get to Blazor, if you're using Angular or React, are you building the whole front end in that, and therefore Razor pages don't have any meaning anymore? Are you just using ASP.NET for the back end, or do they work together, or what am I missing?
They definitely can work together. So some people, you know, one thing that I think developers do a little too much is choose sides and kind of have a religion. I feel like we need to look at all these things, especially with the web, as they're all different tools, right? And so some applications, I feel like the best way to do it is you've got a web app, like say, for instance, a website like Amazon, right? And I'm browsing Amazon and I've got tons of product pages, you know, millions of product pages, and all those product pages should be indexable by Google, and they should be, there's not really much interaction with them. There's a buy button, and then I go from that to a shopping cart. And then the shopping cart is more interactive, and I may be, you know, changing quantities, and I may be interacting with things. And then there's also, you know, I'm sure administration administration parts of the site where you're, you know, administering more like a spreadsheet sort of view of different products and all that kind of stuff and orders and fulfillment, shippers and that sort of thing. So I would break that site up into the pages themselves. I would build something like that using Razor Pages or MVC. It's server rendered data, can be cached and all that. And then the stuff that you're interacting with more, that's more like an application, I would build that out using your front end technologies like Angular, React, Vue, or now Blazor.
Okay, so those four I'm just trying to nail this down so it's clear in my head because I think there's been a lot of ambiguity about that. Let's think of those four as one set of alternatives, and I'm sure there are advantages to each, but they are essentially the SPA technology. Is that correct?
Okay. Exactly.
And ASP.NET is both back end and potentially interactive front end, but not single page application.
Yeah. So the ways that ASP.NET has worked with single page applications, one is there's this whole thing with JavaScript services, and there are templates. So I can do file, new project, Angular app. And what that does for me, basically, two things. It saves me a day of trying to figure out how to get ASP.NET on the back end and Angular on the front end working together. It has all that wire up stuff. And then it also does some really clever stuff as far as handling routing and handling, just the interaction between client and server. It does
what's
some
the,
good.
What's the it in that sentence?
So I would just say the templates, the project templates. And some of the magic goo in there is JavaScript services, which is a thing Steve Sanderson probably heard of. He's worked on Blazor. He's worked on Knockout.js. He's done a ton of really cool stuff there. And so he kind of led this JavaScript services effort, which was, a look at making JavaScript-based front-end applications, Node, all that stuff, play well with ASP.NET. But I want to talk about Blazor, because I feel like So what has happened over time, we started having these more complex applications running on the front end. And JavaScript, we started to really care about JavaScript performance. And, it's amazing to me what these, browser vendors have been able to build to optimize JavaScript performance. So, some of that is building binary representations of the JavaScript so that it's not just, so that it's like, even if it's JIT compiled or whatever, that it can optimize that and it can save binary stuff. So it's not just interpreting it as script. And over time, then there was this kind of move. They said, well, what about, can we represent some stuff that's abstract enough, it's mostly like mathematical or whatever, into a subset of the JavaScript language? And if so, then can we optimize that? Can we, compile that better? And so that, there was ASM.js, and then that evolved into WebAssembly or WASM. And WebAssembly, the idea there was, hey, we're working with this kind of binary format. It doesn't even need to necessarily come from JavaScript. Any language, it could be C or Rust or now C#, that can compile to WebAssembly, we can execute it in the same JavaScript sandbox and just treat it like it was JavaScript.
Okay.
So what happened then at NDC London a few years ago, Steve Sanderson was just doing a survey of browser technologies. What are some, what are some browser technologies? What's possible? What's, and almost kind of looking at things like with the whole Gartner quadrant thing of like, should you evaluate this? Is it time to invest? Is this too crazy to look at yet? And so when he went to WebAssembly, he basically cobbled together using some libraries and stuff he found, .NET to C compiler, and then he used that to compile that to WebAssembly. And so he basically ran some .NET code in the browser, and everyone's minds exploded and they're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So then over time, there was a lot of interest from the community, and this was really kind of a grassroots effort because the .NET team itself doesn't want to jump into building anything, especially the managers don't want to commit to any product unless they're sure there's a need for it. And so it took the community strongly asking for, hey, we want this thing. And so then the team built this out. So Steve Sanderson, Dan Roth, several other really smart people, and community input as well. And so that's what Blazor is. So Blazor is this, it is a front end technology. So you can slot it in with things like Angular, React, Vue. It executes in the client, and it's C# and HTML. So
it's building It is building a spa application using C#. Is that right?
That's correct.
So That's mind blowing.
So yeah, it is. It is. And so then, a lot of questions, people start jumping in with like, is this Silverlight? And, I think that's a good question. Yeah. Well, we both have fond memories of Silverlight, but there were some problems with Silverlight. One was that it was a browser plugin or an add-in or whatever it was. It didn't build on web standards.
Well, there barely were web standards at the time to do that.
Very true.
Silverlight at its peak was just beginning to compete with HTML5. HTML5 was more nascent than real when Silverlight started.
Yep. So now,
I have to defend Silverlight. I'm sorry.
No. Absolutely. I think Silverlight was amazing at the time. And I feel like, really with Blazor, we're getting back to that now that browsers have finally kind of caught up to that. So now that HTML5 is a real thing, browser standards are good. WebAssembly is a browser standard. So, this is something where Microsoft is with Blazor is basically shipping something that runs on top of all the web standard stuff. So I don't need to install anything. I can build a Blazor app and just, assume it's going to work wherever browsers support WebAssembly. And it has fallback WebAssembly, and also even there's fallback for like ASM.js. So
go ahead.
Well, so that's kind of the, what is the C# and how does this fit in, if people are jumping into the, is this Silverlight? And then another thing that's different between Silverlight and Blazor is that it is, from the front end point of view, the browser really treats it as if it's code. It happens to be C# and not JavaScript, but it's just code. And then it's HTML and JavaScript, and it can work with, HTML and CSS, and it can work with JavaScript on the front end. So for, web developers that are used to, they're working with Bootstrap and they're working with, all their kind of, it doesn't require you to change your front end development UI at all. So that's kind of neat too.
Wait, you can create Blazor Spa written in C# and still use Bootstrap?
Exactly. Yeah, because it's still HTML and CSS on the front end. So you're not compiling or doing anything different as far as your front end. Now you can build components and all that, but those render to HTML.
Okay, but when you say the front end, you don't mean as opposed to the server. You mean as opposed to the logic that's still on the browser.
Yeah, so what's in the browser is HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and then your WebAssembly, code that's executed. Mm-hmm. So some nice things with that. One is, it fits in very nicely with web standards, fits in with the existing page. You can use Blazor, as part of a website, and it all plays well together. Another really cool thing, in addition to, hey, if I'm a C# developer and I feel a lot more comfortable writing C# than I do JavaScript and, not creating weird bugs or security issues or whatever, C# is a nice language. But another really cool thing people don't think of right away is the whole packaging thing. It's really simple. So I was mentioning earlier about how complicated Grunt, Gulp, WebAssembly, all those things are in terms of bundling and managing your JavaScript packages. Well, You can use NuGet packages if you're doing Blazor. So for instance, if I need to do something with JSON manipulation, I can use JSON.net, or whatever. I can use my NuGet packages and just, continue using them. I can also share C# code between client and server. So it's very common if you're doing anything with, any kind of models, that I would need to have those on the client and the server. So for instance, if I was using, going back to my Amazon example before, I had products. So I would need a product class on my server. That's a C# class. And then with Angular, I would probably need a product JavaScript class as well. And I need to keep those in sync. If I start adding on, product discount on the server, I better have that product discount in my JavaScript as well. And now I need to, deal with, there's differences in types and all that kind of stuff. Well, with a shared, with Blazor, I can have a shared project and use that on the client as well. So I can have a product C# class in the client, and there's nothing to keep in sync. It's the same class.
That's great.
Yeah.
The only risk I see with investing in Blazor is that there are considerably more JavaScript programmers than there are C# programmers. And so from a practical, I'm looking for work position, it may be a while before Blazor is on that list that people are looking for.
Yeah, that's fair. I feel like, you know, it is in terms of being a .NET developer and just, you know, looking at all the different things I can learn, Blazor is relatively quick to pick up because it's C# code and NuGet and all that. So it's all those familiar things. And I can add it to my list along with other, you know, JavaScript and other front end libraries and stuff.
Right.
So
you
are absolutely true. It is. So as far as where Blazor is in the whole product life cycle, Blazor server side just shipped at .NET Conf in September. So it's shipped and supported and all that. And then Blazor client side is planned, I believe, for May 2020. So it's still in a preview and it's not in a, you know, the official recommendation is to use the Blazor server side model. So,
but you would do that for server side apps, but not for SPAs until the front end part comes out in May.
Okay. Well, here's where it gets a little complicated. So the whole thing with piling to WebAssembly and all that stuff is it's new. WebAssembly is new. The compiling of .NET code to WebAssembly is new. And it's, you know, part of the problem with it, or part of the thing that they're still working on making good between now and May, is getting the size of the WebAssembly compiled stuff down as small as possible. So it can still be a pretty big download. Although really when you compare it to other web frameworks, it's not huge. But over time, people said, hey, this is neat. But maybe I've got a case where I need to execute some code on the server. So what they ended up with, there's basically a toggle where I can execute my Blazor code on the client or on the server. So what that means is I can use this Blazor development model in server-side mode. And what that does is it sends the HTML down to the client. It executes the Blazor code that would be in WebAssembly. It executes that on the server, and it connects between the two of those using SignalR. So it's shipping those updates down to the client. And it's executing the code on the server, and it's making those, but it's not reloading the page or anything like that. It's still functioning as a single page application. So yeah.
God help somebody who's coming into this with no experience who wants to become a web programmer these days.
Well, I do feel, yes, it's true. I do feel like there's different, you know, you can layer on what you need. So if you are building mostly if you're building an application that's a traditional website, then Razor Pages is pretty quick to jump into. If you are building something that really requires front-end application, then, you know, you've got, if you're looking at what the you know, what's established and in the broader job market and all that, there's Angular. And I do feel like ASP.NET is an ASP.NET developer. You can do file new Angular and have an Angular app up and running quick. And then, you know, looking at either future technologies or, you know, also, you know, things like an enterprise or things like that, where you have, I don't know, you're more looking at, you're not shipping a product and all that. Blazor is definitely something where it's easier to jump into. And I do recommend that .NET Conf, so the .NET Conf videos are up on YouTube, and Dan Roth does a fantastic job of presenting Blazor. I feel like I've dug into some of the technicalities of it that maybe make it sound more complicated than it is. It really is pretty quick to say, hey, file new project Blazor. Here's a page that gets temperature data from the server. There's an API on the server. Here's a Blazor page. And it's almost, you know, it's a very lightweight development model where you're back to using components and properties and bindings. It almost feels like the best of, you know, what made WebForms such a compelling model. A lot of that stuff is there in Blazor now. So it's more of a component-based development model. And that's something, you know, as I talk to people that are like, whoa, the whole web has just seemed way too complex. And, you know, it hasn't been easy to get into. And I feel like Blazor brings a lot of that simplicity back.
I'm going to ask you to send me some of those links, especially the YouTube link.
Sure.
And we'll put that up on the show page. But this has been an incredibly information-rich show. And my hope is that I'll have you back really soon to continue this story, because I think you've clarified an enormous amount that's been sort of buzzing around as a bunch of terms, but not necessarily held together.
Yeah, I would love to. One area just to mention for completeness that I didn't even get into at all, but with .NET Core 3, one of the big features outside of the web world is support for WPF and WinForms. So if you're building, you know, WPF and WinForms, if you're building those apps, they still only run on Windows, but if you want to basically update to take advantage of all this performance and self-contained side-by-side installs and all that are in .NET Core, you can upgrade, you know, or build new WebForms and WinForms and WPF applications running on .NET Core. So that's a, you know, a huge update as well.
Are there implications for Xamarin?
Let me see. So I'm not a Xamarin expert. I know that Xamarin has had some updates, but as far as implications, I'm not sure. I don't know. I would recommend getting a Xamarin person on to get the kind of newest on that.
Fair enough. I will dig into it and I will find the right person. John, I can't thank you enough. This has been just truly brilliant.
Thank you. I've had a lot of fun talking, as always.
We'll talk soon. And I'm going to send this out with dramatic piano, it says here on Zencastr. Let's see what that does as we leave. Oh, it is kind of dramatic. All right. Take care, John.
Hey, thanks
a bunch.
We'll talk
soon. Bye-bye.